Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus in biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at Bevelin, Switzerland, and I will be your host today. Today we'll be talking to Andrew Lees about the new book, Brain Spotting: Adventures in Neurology. For fans of Oliver Sacks and Henry Marsh, a glimpse into the fascinating world of modern neurology by a leading expert in the field. Well, Andrew, welcome to the show.
Many thanks.
So how are you? How was your week?
Very good. I mean, the weather in London is not particularly good for this time of year, but otherwise things have been good.
Excellent. So can you tell us, what do you do?
So I'm a neurologist, which I've been for 45 years now, working at the same hospital, which is the National Hospital of Queen Square. It's a small boutique hospital specializing only in neurology, neurosurgery, and a little bit of psychiatry, situated in the a quiet square in the West End of London. It was founded in 1860 and was really the beginning of neurology in the United Kingdom. It was built around the same time as Charcot was doing his pioneering studies in Paris at the Salpêtrière Hospital. And it's managed to survive despite all the healthcare reforms and all the changes in society over the years. So it still really serves as a sort of cradle for British neurology.
Oh, wow. It sounds like a really inspiring place.
Yes, it's inspiring because of the colleagues, really. I mean, I think we have almost 100 neurologists and neurosurgeons, and a lot of very bright young clinical fellows, so that you learn not just from your ancestors who have passed on their knowledge by word of mouth and the oral tradition of neurology, but you also learn, of course, from your bright young fellows. So you're learning from the past and you're learning from the future at the same time. I mean, one of the potential disadvantages is that it's purely neurology. So that can lead to some difficulties and incestuousness in relation to the speciality, and that we don't, at least in that hospital, have too much connection with people working in other medical specialities. But most of us work partly at the National Hospital and also at busy district general hospitals. So this stops us getting too introverted and obsessed with neurology, because I think that is potentially a danger, because many of the important advances in neurology have come out of general medicine or out of science, you know, so it's important to keep a very open mind and not become too narrow-minded and focused just on your particular speciality.
So you have a wealth of experience throughout your stellar career. So what would you say to our student listeners and early career researchers?
Well, I would say be a light unto yourself, question everything. One of the things I've always remembered from my relationship, my virtual relationship with my invisible mentor, William Burroughs, who taught me in the 1960s that nothing is true and everything is permitted. And I think this is quite a good thing for young people to keep in mind, so that if you have an idea, if you have a conviction, if you have a belief, even if everybody else in the community in which you work deride it, stick to your guns and don't let people put you off. And of course, as far as career is concerned, follow your dream. Don't be pushed into a system or a process that contravenes what you want to do. So, you know, we live in an increasingly controlled and regulated environment. And I think that it's important that at times you have to fight against that, or at least learn ways how to survive within it.
So your latest book is Brain Spotting: Adventures in Neurology. So what inspired you to write it?
Well, I've you know, my career, I've written a large number of scientific papers. And as you probably know, you're not allowed to talk about yourself when you're writing about science. That certainly wouldn't be de rigueur. So as I came towards the end of my career, I mean, I'm still seeing patients, but I've certainly downsized and I'm doing much less clinical work than I used to do. I wanted really to write about myself, and not just for a sort of narcissistic reason, but in the hope that a speciality which had been so much fun and so much enjoyable, had given me so much enjoyment as much as and so much satisfaction, that I could actually try and convey some of the things that I'd learned during my apprenticeship and then as a consultant neurologist to younger people. So it was one of my first teachers of neurology at University College Hospital, William Goody, who was a very interesting and cultured person. When I started neurology, of course, he reminded me that it's a very long apprenticeship, even longer than that of a Vestal Virgin in ancient Rome. So you need to study and learn from patients for at least 8 or 9 years in order to become reasonably competent as a clinical neurologist. But he also gave me some other interesting pieces of advice. For example, he told me not to spend too much time in the library reading textbooks of neurology, but rather spend time at the bedside talking to patients. And when I'd made a decision as to what neurological disorder they were suffering from, if I didn't know much about it, just go and look up a little bit about that particular condition in the library, but don't sort of start reading a textbook from start to finish. And then he gave me a couple of very interesting book recommendations rather than reading textbooks of neurology. He told me to read the Sherlock Holmes canon, which I'd already read as a schoolboy, so that was not too difficult for me to do, but I wasn't quite sure at that point why he was recommending it to me at the beginning of my neurological career. And then he gave me an even more challenging recommendation, and that was to read In Search of Lost Time by Marcel Proust. He had a particular interest in time and neurology, which I suspect might have partly influenced this second literary recommendation. And then one day, as we were leaving the ward, he said to me, "Lise, you know, neurology is a very serious business, but it must also be soulful." And again, I wasn't really quite sure what he meant by that at the time as a very young and insecure trainee. But as my career went on, I began to understand much more what he meant by romantic neurology and the importance of trying to understand the lives of the patients that we treat, and that patients are much more than just a disease, and that in order to be a good neurologist, you need to get out from the hospital and embrace yourself in the life of the patients who you treat. So what he said to me on another occasion was that, I like to be able to, if I see a patient of mine in the street after they've been discharged from the hospital, I like to be able to talk to them about things other than their medical condition. And this struck a note with me, and it made me, in a way, as a researcher, become a sort of field worker, where I didn't confine my research into neurology to the hospital or to the laboratory. I went out into the big wide world where patients lived.
So how does this approach differ to what we used to think about how neurologists treat their patients, at least when the profession has just begun?
Well, what really attracted me as a medical student to neurology was that it seemed to be more rational and based on a systematic approach, rather like carrying out a laboratory experiment. So the physical examination, which even today has not been superseded by technology, is a very rigorous system that you start at the top of the brain, then you work down through the cranial nerves to the motor system, the sensory system, and so on. And remarkably, although, of course, we cannot see the brain in real life, of course, you can now get images of the brain with modern technology, but an image of the brain is, despite its definition, is still not exactly the same as the brain. So what is remarkable really about the physical examination, which we pay so much lip service to in neurology, is that through a system of semiotics, the elicitation of physical signs at the bedside, we can deduce what's actually going on inside the nervous system. So to give you an example, if I tap the knee jerk and the knee jerk is absent, this tells me that there is something wrong with the nerve root, the third lumbar nerve motor root, and that the reflex arc has been damaged. So the examination helps us enormously in localizing the site of the lesion. So some neurosurgeons, for example, will say to you, "Well, we don't need that anymore because we've got technology, we've got nerve conduction studies, we've got brain scans and so on. So we don't need to waste time tapping people's reflexes." But the truth of the matter is that you cannot, even with the most sophisticated modern technology of today, you cannot get this information by using a machine. So it's very interesting that 100 years on, this formalized examination has survived. And as I've already mentioned, I really do associate it in a little with the rigorousness that one needs in a chemistry experiment. Now, the history, the medical history, is the other critical part of the neurological diagnostic system. And we are almost as detailed as psychiatrists in this. So we listen, and to take a good medical interview lasts probably, if you do it properly and you're seeing a new patient, for at least 45 minutes. So you by listening with intent and listening attentively, you can get the diagnosis in at least 3/4 of all patients with neurological problems. So it is still, even in the 21st century, the most reliable and most important aspect of clinical practice for a neurologist. So that if you are good at taking a history, and this takes a lot of practice, you have to know when to be quiet. You have to allow the patient to tell their own story without interrupting every 10 seconds. And then you need to ask a few focused, open-ended questions in order to hone down on what you suspect from what the patient has taught you. So there is a very specific method for taking the medical history that is used in medicine. It has similarities and differences, for example, to that of a criminal investigator or from a lawyer. So there are slight differences in the approach, but all of them depend on listening very carefully, and not only listening, but also paying attention to the patient's body language while they're actually giving the clinical history. So you can pick up subliminal things like, is the patient very worried or anxious? Is there a hidden agenda? Is the patient depressed? All of these things you can pick up, not necessarily through what they say, but through how they look while you're actually taking the history. So the history taking actually gives you another opportunity to, in a way, observe the patient. And the other thing which is quite important is to pay attention to the tone of the voice of the patient as they're giving the history. And over the years, I've also learned that the tone of my own voice is very important as a therapeutic aid. So that the way you speak to people in a medical consultation is absolutely important. It can be therapeutic in its own right, without you needing to get your prescription pad out or recommend surgery. So these are very important things, which I think with all the exciting science and all the advances in what we can do for patients and in the technology particularly, have a tendency to be neglected because they take a bit of time, and everybody curiously these days thinks they haven't got enough time to do anything, not even enough time to think. So going back to Dr. Goody, one of the things he said when I started my training was, Lise, when do you spend time thinking? Which again was something which I hadn't really thought of, but I thought of it a lot afterwards. And I do try to, even now, spend a little bit of the day away from my computer thinking about things, important things.
So does this approach to examination and relationship with patients contribute to what you call holistic neurology?
Holistic is, I suppose, a term that means different things to different people. Mm. If it means that I'm interested in the life of the patient as well as just the disease that I've diagnosed, then yes, I think it is that. I think it's it's also it's also in a way it's a word that's not used very much these days, but it's also a sort of romantic approach to medicine in that it involves compassion. I mean, I think compassion. In neurology, when I started, we had rather few treatments. There was a bit of a joke in the medical profession that neurologists spent hours talking to people a bit like psychiatrists, but they didn't really have very many treatments to offer them. But happily, things have changed a little bit from the point of view of therapeutics now, so it's much better than it was. But we still have our fair share of incurable, brutal disorders to deal with. And I think this is where kindness can come in. And, you know, healing people is much more than just writing out prescriptions for tablets or offering them surgery. It's almost a magical quality which transcends evidence-based medicine. And I think what part of the reason for writing my book is to try to remind particularly younger colleagues and those who worship science and technology that's all very well and good, and we're all extremely grateful for the advances in technology, but the rest shouldn't be forgotten. So in that sense, it is a sort of more holistic approach. It's not I certainly don't think you can reduce neurology to a list of scales or a checklist because it's far too sophisticated and the brain is far too complicated for that kind of process to ever be useful.
So could you give us a glimpse into the day in the life of neurologist?
Well, of course, like all like scientists, like doctors, it's of course different. There are different types of neurologists. I mean, the typical neurologist, I would say, or at least perhaps I could describe my own life. So I was a consulting neurologist, a staff neurologist at a teaching hospital. So my work would involve doing a ward round perhaps twice a week at the bedside, seeing patients, talking to them, telling them what we thought was wrong with them and what we were going to do to try to help them. A lot of the work would be done in outpatients, and that became even more prevalent as we got new technology, so that some of the conditions that when I started we would have had to admit to the hospital for assessment, investigation and treatment could now be dealt with in the clinic. So as time went on, there was less inpatient hospital work and more outpatient clinic work, seeing perhaps 10 patients in the morning, 3 or 4 new ones and 6 follow-ups. And then, of course, there would be the teaching, and I'm a great believer in the small seminar for postgraduates and for undergraduates, so teaching a small group of students so that they get to know you and and you can show them personally how to do things. And sometimes when we were short of patients on the ward, I used to take the undergraduates round the underground line in London. So you will probably know that one of the lines is called the Circle Line, which comes back to where it starts, and it takes about an hour to get round the line. So it's a good time period for doing a teaching session. So What I used to say to them before we left the hospital was that I don't want you to make diagnoses, and of course you mustn't make it obvious to anybody that you're staring at them. You have to try to melt into the background and become as if you were a spy, so that you're observing people without them knowing that you're observing them. And I want you to observe behavior. I want you to observe abnormal movements. I want you to observe their mannerisms. If they get off the train, I want you to observe how they walk. And then when we, so that they would do, and of course I told them they mustn't take photographs, of course. This was all an exercise in observing. And then equally important, trying to describe what you have seen. And this is something which is absolutely vital to be a good neurologist. So it's no good being a good noticer if you can't translate what you notice into words that you can explain to colleagues. So part of noticing is the written and verbal description. And again, this takes a little bit of time. And some people are, of course, much better at it than others. Some are good with similes and metaphors that bring physical signs to life. So this was not really an exercise in diagnosis. So we weren't going around the Circle Line trying to make medical diagnoses. It was more an exercise, for example, if you had witnessed a crime and you were being interviewed by the police to describe the assailant or the robber, well, how would you describe them? Because I think you can improve your observation skills. It's not, some people are very gifted, and many of these people become artists. And it's interesting that many of the pioneering neurologists like Charcot and Gowers at my hospital had art as their hobby. So that they outside medicine, drawing and painting was the thing they liked to do best. So there is, if you've got a good eye and if you're a visionary, this gives you a very good start in neurology. And I was quite good because at school I had two competing passions. One was art and the other was science. And I couldn't find a way of reconciling them, because in the British system of education at that time, you had to decide if you wanted to go on the art side or the science side. And it was only when my parents very wisely nudged me towards medicine that I was able to bring these two interests together. So I was able to link the art of healing with the science of modern medicine. And I think if you're this sort of personality, then medicine is quite a good choice for you. I found mathematics and physics quite difficult to do. I was okay with them, but biology and chemistry were the things on the science side that I was more interested in. So this was one thing that I think is related to what I've called soulful neurology.
Oh, wow, that lesson sounds absolutely fantastic. I bet you can learn so much more about human condition than just going through the books in the library.
Yes, yeah. I think you'll know from your own training that you need to be shown sometimes how to see things. Mm. And in order to really become proficient, you need to do things. So what I've always tried to do with my student teaching is involve them. And in medicine, one of the ways you can involve people is, of course, by getting them to see the patients, because the patients are the best teachers. We as doctors, a neurologist, we learn more from our patients than we do by listening to what they tell us than we do from anything else. So I'm not such a fan of too much formal lecturing. I mean, I think obviously to listen to an inspired eminent neurologist who is a good orator can leave a lasting mark in some situations. And at Queen Square, we still maintain what's called the old-fashioned clinical grand round, which has become logistically rather more difficult to do with modern society. But a method of teaching that was started by Charcot at the Salpêtrière Hospital in 1860. And what we do is that, with informed consent, and we usually don't have much difficulty getting the consent of the patient to agree. The patient comes down to the auditorium and the junior doctors present the history, and then the consultant in charge of the grand round will then elicit the physical signs, so that the audience, although they're at a distance, still have the opportunity to see masters eliciting neurological signs and learning in a more formal setting rather than the bedside, a way of how to do the examination. So I'm still fond of that. And the other teaching method, which I think we've been keen to preserve at Queen Square, is the clinico-pathological conference. So the way this works is that one of the junior doctors presents the clinical case of a person who has died and has donated her brain for pathological examination. And I think pathology is the gold standard of neurology. And even with modern scanning, there are many conditions that we cannot diagnose apart from at autopsy. And the autopsy also helps neurologists to remain humble and avoid hubris, because we often find that there is more than one thing wrong with the brain when we come to examine it at post-mortem. So the junior doctor presents the clinical history, and then the audience have to speculate on what the neuropathologist might have found on examining the brain. And after the discussion and speculation is completed, the neuropathologist presents the findings that have occurred at post-mortem. And I think this clinico-pathological correlation still underpins diagnostic method in neurology, as it does in many aspects of medicine. Of course, genetics has added a new element of taxonomy to the way we describe conditions, but pathology is still particularly important, I think, in neurological practice. So we try very hard to get autopsies, particularly from people with disorders that we're not certain what they had in life, so that we can try and improve knowledge and also feedback to the family about what actually was the cause of their loved one's demise.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So this kind of approach to neurology is obviously very valuable, and that's something that's put across very well in your book as well. So I was wondering, is there enough space and even time within the modern medicine for these approaches to be kind of put mainstream?
Well, you have to fight for them. I mean, nobody wants to pay for pathology these days. And, you know, there are certain threads within society. I mean, for example, there are certain religious groups who wish for their loved ones to be buried very rapidly after death. So it's become quite a lot harder to carry out post-mortem examinations, which I think is a great pity, because when I was a student, every lunchtime we used to go to the post-mortem room, and the morbid anatomists would present the patients who had died overnight or that morning and were having autopsies to the students. And it was although it was... You know, it was a kind of ritualistic trial to see if you could survive medicine, because it was fairly gruesome the first time one went to the post-mortem room. Not just the smell, but the you know, entrails and organs littered all over the autopsy room. It was really a wonderful way of not just learning anatomy, but also learning how difficult medicine was, because the physician who had looked after the case would be there and would explain what they thought had been wrong. And there were often, as I've already mentioned, with the clinico-pathological case rounds, there were often mismatches, so that misdiagnosis was not infrequent in that situation. I would say in about one in five patients, surprises occurred at autopsy. And what's very interesting is that despite all the advances in medical technologies that have occurred, recent papers from the United States, where there are more than 70 million medical errors every year, have shown that medical misdiagnosis, despite brain scans and all the other things, is still running at the same level as it was 30 or 40 years ago, which is really a surprising and rather shocking finding, I think.
So where do you see that technology can really contribute to modern neurology? And especially many of us would be wondering after COVID pandemic that some of these sessions were held over Zoom, you know?
Yes. Yeah, if you ask me what's the greatest advance that has happened during my career as a neurologist, I would say magnetic resonance imaging by a long way. So this is the thing that has really changed the face of neurology. But in the wrong hands, it can become a weapon of mass destruction, and it can be used for profit making. It can be used in many, many bad ways. So like all technology, it's how you use it. And you mustn't become a slave to the technology. A good neurologist uses the available technologies for the benefit of his or her patients and doesn't misuse them. And the, you know, the to give you an example of the egregious profit-making misuse of drugs, of imaging techniques. In my book, I describe a patient who had headaches in Florida, and he phoned up a local hospital because he was very frightened. He was asked to come immediately. On arriving at the hospital reception, he had to give his credit card. He was then taken immediately without seeing a doctor. He filled in a checkbox about headache. You know, how long have you had your headache? 2 hours. What kind of headache is it? And then he was taken without seeing a doctor to the imaging suite. The following day, he saw a doctor who was sitting in a very large office with a lot of diplomas behind him in a desk, in an enormous desk that meant that he was distanced, the patient was distanced from this doctor by several meters, so he wasn't at all close to the doctor. And the doctor's chair seemed to be higher than the patient's chair. The doctor asked him a couple of questions, not a very cursory history lasting about 5 minutes, didn't examine him at all. He didn't even touch him and said, your scan shows some little white dots. We need to do a whole pile of other tests. So he went through another pile of investigations, all of this costing a lot of money. At the end of it all, nothing really definitive was decided. The patient was told that he needed to have repeat scans back in England in about 6 months. And when I saw this man, his headaches, which initially had improved a little because he felt that this system seemed to be super efficient and everything was being done very well, had come back quite quickly, particularly when he learned that there were some subtle abnormalities on his scan. By the time he got back to London, his headaches had come back. So I spent some time talking to him. I touched him. I put my hands on his head. I looked for causes of headache, felt his muscles, and so on, and reassured him that the small abnormalities that had been found on the scan were not relevant in any way to his headaches. So I liken them really to, as we get older, you know, we start to get little blemishes on our skin, which are of no pathological significance. So I likened these findings on the scan to that, which seemed to reassure him. And when he came back 2 weeks later, his headaches had gone. So, you know, this is an example of very bad medicine, I would say, awful medicine. So, you know, it's like everything in modern life. It's like, how do we use our own computers? We have to use them judiciously and carefully. And if we do, then they can be of great value. Now, with respect to Zoom, you'll get, you know, people have different views about Zoom. I think from the point of view of education, as we're doing now, it certainly has a very important role, particularly with respect to outreach. I mean, I think, of course, we can reach far more people than we're ever able to do in a lecture theatre. Mm. I'm quite a fan of the hybrid model. I don't think it will ever totally replace the charismatic, brilliant orator giving a lecture to a keynote lecture in an auditorium, because I think it's a bit like a musician who is live. And, you know, if you like Bruce Springsteen, you want to go and see Bruce Springsteen live. You don't just want to listen to his records. But I think certly in education, it's got an important role. And I think COVID, in that sense, has made us pick up speed. You know, we should have probably been much quicker at using it more. Now, when it comes to medical consultations, I'm less convinced. Certainly, I don't think it could be used to replace a new consultation in neurology. I think this would be indefensible in a court of law, where you need to touch people, you need to examine people, and you cannot do this appropriately over a computer. Also, you cannot tell bad news over a computer, or at least I don't think you should be telling people bad news over a computer. I think it's got its uses. For example, in people who are very incapacitated with chronic neurological handicap, and for example, they would find it almost impossible or at least a great effort to get to the hospital to see their doctor. So provided that doctor knows them very well and knows of their problems, then I think for certain follow-up consultations, it can be useful and gives us another dimension. But, you know, it's certainly not going to replace face-to-face work in hospital practice, not least because, you know, our juniors need to learn from live patients how to diagnose and treat people. So telemedicine, from an educational point of view, I'm a great fan. Teleconsultations, I think it may have a very limited role, combined also with the telephone call. I mean, I think as you, I'm sure you know, one of the things about Zoom is that there is a lag in the voice time and the sound. And the expressions of the patient are not quite the same as if you're seeing them face to face. So there are subtle differences which take a little bit of time to get used to.
So where would you like to see the field of neurology going forwards in the future?
I think, you know, we have more than although there have been considerable advances in neurological therapeutics over the last 30 years, particularly in the fields of epilepsy, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis. And of course, we've now got thrombolysis to treat certain types of stroke if we can get them quickly. We still have a huge number of very serious, untreatable and incurable neurological disorders. So we are a long way behind, for example, cancer research, which has had made far more inroads into therapeutics in the last 20 years than we've managed to do in neurology. And of course, we're light years behind cardiology that has been revolutionized in the last 40 years. So, you know, we need to find better ways of understanding what causes these disorders, to have a more open mind about dealing with them. So that, you know, I mean, in science, as you probably know, I mean, science, like art, runs in fashion, and everybody gets fixed now on one particular idea or one possible pathogenetic cause, say, for example, Alzheimer's disease. And a more left field imaginative approach is more difficult because grant giving bodies are fairly monolithic and rigid in the way they look at things. And if they are faced with a grant application that they don't know much about, or they they unfairly often call it a fishing trip, it tends not to get funded. So I think the whole system really does need a sort of shake-up, a real revision. I think citizen science and patient involvement in research has started, but it needs to go much faster. And I think if you look at the history of my own area of research, Parkinson's disease, a lot of the most important findings have occurred by serendipity, by chance, by folkloric observations, by patient observations, by chance findings in the laboratory. So I think if there was a way of teaching serendipity at university, I think this would be quite a useful way forward. I mean, we've spent billions in neurology and in neurodegenerative disorders in the last 30 years. We've spent billions and billions of dollars on potential neuroprotective and disease modifying treatments, and nothing has come out of it. So I think it's not unreasonable to ask the question, should we be doing things in a different way? I mean, as far as neurological practice is concerned, I think one of my fears at the moment is that the good doctor and the good scientist are being split apart. When I started in neurology, it was possible to be a dilettante, and we were able to do clinical research and collaborate with basic scientists, and at the same time have enough plenty of time to see a good number of patients. So you could divide your week between being a good clinical doctor, say 3 days a week, and 2 days a week either doing clinical research yourself or at least working with a team to do it. And I think that model has become quite difficult now, because what's happening is that certainly in the US, the best clinicians are now working outside the big centers, because the big centers, all they're interested in is getting big grants, getting a lot of money, and they're not really very interested either in good clinical practice or in medical education. So this is a split which really worries me. And I would like to hope that a mechanism could happen so that clinician scientists could really be clinician scientists. And what I mean by that is that they're not leave the science to the scientists, because they're better at doing it. So when I talk about clinical scientist, I talk about somebody who is curious about questions that their patients ask them and they can't answer. So, for example, Professor Lees, I've got Parkinson's disease, will I get dementia? Hmm. So this is a question that I can't at the moment give a clear answer to, and I would like to give a clear answer to that. And one of the ways of trying to give a clear answer to that is, of course, by studying patients clinically in more detail and depth. So deep phenotyping, if you like, is one of the things which I think is in danger a little bit at the present time.
And what discoveries in your research and your process of writing your book, Brain Spotting, surprised you the most?
My book is like a Dr. Faustus in reverse. It's to try and show that you can be a doctor and still keep your soul, if you like. And well, I've tried to do that by picking 10 essays that really describe very important moments and learning exercises during my own career, which, of course, some of them might seem a little ancient now to the modern practicing or the modern trainee, but I think that the messages that lie underneath the actual stories are very pertinent to what is needed today and what really constitutes good medicine. So I think even with all the changes that have occurred in the system, the increasing guidelines, algorithms, the control in the system, the homogenization to try and make us all doctors become like either businessmen or apparatchiks of the state. I think it's still possible to be a good doctor, but you have to work a bit harder on it now. And one of the new phenomena which you'll be familiar with and which has struck down certainly a lot of my colleagues in the United Kingdom is what's called burnout. Of course, burnout means different things to different people, but it's basically that you find it very difficult to go into work every morning to do a job that you once loved and enjoyed doing. And I think one of the ways of combating this, and which is perhaps why I never really felt burnout. I mean, I've always loved going to work. It's never been a chore or an effort to go to work. It is to get this balance in your job description right, and try to find ways of working within these new healthcare systems, which try to strip doctors of their vocation and profession. And for me, that's what I would see as the greatest challenge for romantic, soulful neurologists going forward.
And we all know that neurologists work extremely hard and very busy during the day. So do you have like unlimited coffee on tap on a ward, or do you have to bring your own?
Well, I mean, yeah, I became addicted to coffee, probably most students, but certainly most medical students. So when we were swatting, and then when we were on call as junior doctors to keep awake at night. So I've been very relieved that caffeine is still one of the drugs that we can use without running a risk of harming ourselves. In fact, as far as the brain is concerned, it's very interesting because caffeine is said to reduce the risk of developing Parkinson's disease and possibly also Alzheimer's disease. So nothing so far has come up to suggest that drinking even industrial quantities of caffeine damages the brain. The cardiologists may be a little bit more worried about very big doses with respect to causing heart rhythm problems and so on. But yeah, I think caffeine is a good stimulant. And I've really been interested and still am interested in the possibility of developing a good smart drug that we could all take. You know, modafinil is used now sometimes by students while they're studying. But I think we could develop a better and safer smart drug that would be like caffeine, but would perhaps make us all be able to achieve far more in our everyday lives and also be satisfied by what we do. So I think that I would like to see the pharmaceutical companies working on what I guess is to them quite a high risk topic of developing smart drugs, but I think it might bear fruit.
Well, this has been a truly inspiring discussion, especially to our student listeners. So I wonder, what are you focusing on now, and what will be your next project?
Well, I'm continuing. I'm still curious to find cures for, particularly for Parkinson's disease, which is my special interest. I mean, when I went into neurology in the late 1960s, L-DOPA had just been discovered. And we at that time, it was, of course, the 1960s, so we were full of optimism that we could cure all neurological diseases and that all the common neurodegenerative disorders would prove to be neurochemical deficiencies. Of course, this hasn't proved to be the case. And in fact, L-DOPA, which was the miracle drug of the late 1960s in neurology, is still the best treatment for Parkinson's disease 45 years on. So this, in a sense, has been an enormous disappointment that we haven't managed to find a better symptomatic treatment for Parkinson's disease than levodopa. So, you know, there's no place for complacency, at least in my field. We've not made as much progress as we would like to do. So, you know, I'm still interested in hunting for new treatments and new cures and collaborating with younger colleagues to do that. I think my own my own personal greatest achievement in medicine has been the reintroduction of a drug called apomorphine, a dopamine receptor agonist, into clinical practice in the late 1980s. And this drug is now used all over the world as a treatment for late stage Parkinson's disease, where it's delivered through an ambulatory pump with a needle inserted under the abdominal wall. So that when people ask me what's your greatest achievement, that's what it is. But I'd still like to do even better. I mean, I'm going to continue, obviously, as I mentioned to you earlier, I'm seeing far fewer patients now, so I have more time on my hands. So I'm going to continue to write books, non-fiction books of the sort that I've written with Mentored by a Madman and Brain Spotting. So there may be more Brain Spotting to come in the future.
And what's the best way for our listeners to find more information about your work and also your book?
Well, I'm on Wikipedia. So my Wikipedia entry is correct, I think, at least when I last looked at it. So I think that's quite a good way of just looking me up and what I do and what I've done. The book is published by Notting Hill Editions, who have got a very nice website, which you can readers can easily find. And in that, there is an extract, there's a large extract of the book, which they can read for nothing. If your listeners do decide to buy the book, I would really encourage them to buy the hard copy book, not a Kindle, because the hardback book, no expense has been left in producing a wonderful book that'll last forever. So the boards pure linen, the bookmark is satin. The paper comes from the Lake District in England with a very attractive Gaudemont, Simonetti Gaudemont font. The book is actually printed in Germany. As you probably know, most of the printing of books now goes on in the Far East and in India. So it's really a beautiful production. And I think to read it in Kindle would be a bit like a Zoom consultation compared with a face-to-face consultation. Maybe I can put it like that.
Yes, of course, nothing compares to holding the book in your hand, for sure.
Yeah, and even smell it. I mean, it smells it smells of neurology.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.